We haven't succeeded in shaking Favel off. He's still on our tail.
Yes.
Shopping centres on the outskirts seemed congested. Tired women with crying babies in prams stared into windows. Hawkers shouted. Small boys hung on to the backs of lorries. There were too many people. Too much noise. The very air was irritable and exhausted and spent. The drive through London seemed endless, and by the time we had drawn clear again and were out beyond Hampstead, there was a sound in my head like the beating of a drum, and my eyes were burning. I wondered how tired Maxim was. He was pale, and there were shadows under his eyes, but he did not say anything. Colonel Julian kept yawning at the back. He opened his mouth very wide and yawned aloud, sighing heavily afterwards. He would do this every few minutes. I felt a senseless, stupid irritation come over me, and I did not know how to prevent myself from turning round and screaming to him to stop. Once we had passed Hampstead, he drew out a large-scale map from his coat pocket and began directing Maxim to Barnet. The way was clear, and there were signposts to tell us, but he kept pointing out every turn and twist in the road, and if there was any hesitation on Maxim's part, Colonel Julian would turn down the window and call for information from a passer-by. When we came to Barnet itself, he made Maxim stop every few minutes.
"Can you tell us where a house called Roselands is? It belongs to a Dr. Baker, who's retired and come to live there lately."
And the passer-by would stand frowning a moment, obviously at sea, ignorance written plain upon his face.
"Dr. Baker? I don't know a Dr. Baker. There used to be a house called Rose Cottage near the church, but a Mrs. Wilson lives there."
"No, it's Roselands we want. Dr. Baker's house," said Colonel Julian.
And then we would go on and stop again in front of a nurse and a pram.
"Can you tell us where Roselands is?"
"I'm sorry. I'm afraid I've only just come to live here."
"You don't know a Dr. Baker?"
"Dr. Davidson. I know Dr. Davidson."
"No, it's Dr. Baker we want."
I glanced up at Maxim. He was looking very tired. His mouth was set hard. Behind us crawled Favel, his green car covered in dust. It was a postman who pointed out the house in the end, a square house, ivy-covered, with no name on the gate, which we had already passed twice. Mechanically, I reached for my bag and dabbed my face with the end of the powder puff. Maxim drew up outside at the side of the road. He did not take the car into the short drive. We sat silently for a few minutes.
"Well, here we are," said Colonel Julian, "and it's exactly 5:12. We shall catch them in the middle of their tea. Better wait for a bit."
Maxim lit a cigarette and then stretched out his hand to me. He did not speak. I heard Colonel Julian crinkling his map.
"We could have come right across without touching London," he said. "Saved us 40 minutes, I dare say. We made good time the first 200 miles. It was from Chiswick on we took the time."
An errand boy passed us whistling on his bicycle. A motor coach stopped at the corner, and two women got out. Somewhere a church clock chimed the quarter. I could see Favel leaning back in his car behind us and smoking a cigarette. I seemed to have no feeling in me at all. I just sat and watched the little things that did not matter. The two women from the bus walk along the road. The errand boy disappears round the corner. A sparrow hops about in the middle of the road, pecking at dirt.
"This fellow Baker can't be much of a gardener," said Colonel Julian. "Look at those shrubs tumbling over his wall. They ought to have been pruned right back."
He folded up the map and put it back in his pocket.
"Funny sort of place to choose to retire in," he said. "Close to the main road and overlooked by other houses. Shouldn't care about it myself. I dare say it was quite pretty once before they started building. No doubt there's a good golf course somewhere handy."
He was silent for a while. Then he opened the door and stood out in the road.
"Well, De Winter," he said, "what do you think about it?"
"I'm ready,"
said Maxim. We got out of the car. Favel strolled up to meet us.
"What were you all waiting for? Cold feet?" he said.
Nobody answered him. We walked up the drive to the front door. A strange, incongruous little party. I caught sight of a tennis lawn beyond the house, and I heard the thud of balls. A boy's voice shouted, 40-15, not 30-all. Don't you remember hitting it out, you silly ass?
They must have finished tea, said Colonel Julian.
He hesitated a moment, glancing at Maxim, and he rang the bell. It tinkled somewhere in the back premises. There was a long pause. A very young maid opened the door to us. She looked startled at the sight of so many of us.
Dr. Baker, said Colonel Julian.
Yes, sir. Will you come in?
She opened the door on the left of the hall as we went in. It would be the drawing-room, not used much in the summer. There was a portrait of a very plain, dark woman on the wall. I wondered if it was Mrs. Baker. The chintz covers on the chairs and on the sofa were new and shiny. On the mantelpiece were photographs of two schoolboys with round, smiling faces. There was a very large wireless in the corner of the room by the window. Cords trailed from it, and bits of aerial. Favell examined the portrait on the wall. Colonel Julian went and stood by the empty fireplace. Maxim and I looked out of the window. I could see a deck chair under a tree, and the back of a woman's head. The tennis court must be round the corner. I could hear the boys shouting to each other. A very old Scotch terrier was scratching himself in the middle of the path. We waited there for about 5 minutes. It was as though I was living the life of some other person, and had come to this house to call for a subscription to a charity. It was unlike anything I had ever known. I had no feeling, no pain. Then the door opened, and a man came into the room. He was medium height, rather long in the face, with a keen chin. His hair was sandy, turning grey. He wore flannels and a dark blue blazer. "Forgive me for keeping you waiting," he said, looking a little surprised, as the maid had done, to see so many of us. "I had to run up and wash. I was playing tennis when the bell rang. Won't you sit down?" He turned to me. I sat down in the nearest chair and waited.
"You must think this a very unorthodox invasion, Dr. Baker," said Colonel Julian, "and I apologize very humbly for disturbing you like this. My name is Julian. This is Mr. De Winter, Mrs. De Winter, and Mr. Favell. You may have seen Mr. De Winter's name in the papers recently."
"Oh," said Dr. Baker, "yes, yes, I suppose I have. Some inquest or other, wasn't it? My wife was reading all about it."
"The jury brought in a verdict of suicide," said Favell, coming forward, "which I say is absolutely out of the question. Mrs. De Winter was my cousin. I knew her intimately. She would never have done such a thing, and what's more, she had no motive. What we want to know is what the devil she came to see you about the very day she died."
"You had better leave this to Julian and myself," said Maxim quietly. "Dr. Baker has not the faintest idea what you're driving at." He turned to the doctor, who was standing between them with a line between his brows and his first polite smile frozen on his lips. "My late wife's cousin is not satisfied with the verdict," said Maxim, "and we've driven up to see you today because we found your name and the telephone number of your old consulting rooms in my wife's engagement diary. She seems to have made an appointment with you and kept it at 2 o'clock on the last day she ever spent in London. Could you possibly verify this for us?" Dr. Baker was listening with great interest, but when Maxim had finished, he shook his head. "I'm most awfully sorry," he said, "but I think you've made a mistake. I should have remembered the name De Winter. I've never attended a Mrs. De Winter in my life." Colonel Julian brought out his note-case and gave him the page he had torn from the engagement diary. "Here it is, written down," he said. "Baker, 2 o'clock. And a big cross beside it to show that the appointment was kept. And here is the telephone address, Museum 0488. Dr. Baker stared at the piece of paper. "That's very odd. Very odd indeed. Yes, the number is quite correct, as you say. Could she have come to see you and given a false name?" said Colonel Julian. "Why, yes, that's possible. She may have done that. It's rather unusual, of course. I've never encouraged that sort of thing. It doesn't do us any good in the profession if people think they can treat us like that."
"Would you have any record of the visit in your files?" said Colonel Julian. "I know it's not etiquette to ask, but the circumstances are very unusual. We do feel her appointment with you must have some bearing on the case and her subsequent suicide." "Murder," said Favell.
Dr. Baker raised his eyebrows and looked inquiringly at Maxim.
"I'd no idea there was any question of that," he said quietly. "Of course I understand, and I'll do anything in my power to help you. If you will excuse me a few minutes, I will go and look up my files. There should be a record of every appointment book throughout the year, and a description of the case. Please help yourself to cigarettes. It's too early to offer you sherry, I suppose."
Colonel Julian and Maxim shook their heads. I thought Favell was going to say something, but Dr. Baker had left the room before he had a chance.
"Seems a decent sort of fellow," said Colonel Julian.
"Why didn't he offer us whiskey and soda?" said Favell. "Keeps it locked up, I suppose. I didn't think much of him. I don't believe he's going to help us now."
Maxim did not say anything. I could hear the sound of the tennis balls from the court. The Scotch terrier was barking. A woman's voice shouted to him to be quiet. The summer holidays. Baker playing with his boys. We had interrupted their routine. A high-pitched gold clock in a glass case ticked very fast on the mantelpiece. There was a postcard of the Lake of Geneva leaning against it. The Bakers had friends in Switzerland. Dr. Baker came back into the room with a large book and a file case in his hands. He carried them over to the table. "I've brought the collection for last year," he said. "I haven't been through them yet since we moved. I only gave up practice 6 months ago, you know." He opened the book and began turning the pages. I watched him, fascinated. He would find it, of course. It was only a question of moments now. Of seconds.
"The 7th, 8th, 10th, he murmured. "Nothing here.
"The 12th, did you say? At 2 o'clock? Ah! We none of us moved. We all watched his face.
"I saw a Mrs. Danvers on the 12th at 2 o'clock, he said.
"Danny, what on earth?"
began Favell. But Maxim cut him short.
"She gave a wrong name, of course," he said. "That was obvious from the first. Do you remember the visit now, Dr. Baker?"
But Dr. Baker was already searching his files. I saw his fingers delve into the pocket marked with D. He found it almost at once. He glanced down rapidly at his handwriting.
"Yes," he said slowly. "Yes, Mrs. Danvers. I remember now."
"Tall, slim, dark, very handsome," said Colonel Julian, quietly.
"Yes," said Dr. Baker. "Yes." He read through the files and then replaced them in the case. "Of course," he said, glancing at Maxim. "This is unprofessional, you know. We treat patients as though they were in the confessional. But your wife is dead, and I quite understand the circumstances are exceptional. You want to know if I can suggest any motive why your wife should have taken her life?" "I think I can. The woman who called herself Mrs. Danvers was very seriously ill." He paused. He looked at every one of us in turn. "I remember her perfectly well," he said. And he turned back to the files again. "She came to me for the first time a week previously to the date you mentioned. She complained of certain symptoms, and I took some X-rays of her." The second visit was to find out the result of those X-rays. The photographs are not here, but I have the details written down. I remember her standing in my consulting room and holding out her hand for the photographs. "I want to know the truth," she said. "I don't want soft words and a bedside manner. If I'm for it, you can tell me right away." He paused. He glanced down at the files once again. I waited. Waited. Why couldn't he get done with it and finish and let us go? Why must we sit there waiting, our eyes upon his face?
"Well," he said, "she asked for the truth and I let her have it. Some patients are better for it. Shirking the point does them no good. This Mrs. Danvers, or Mrs. de Winter, rather, was not the type to accept a lie. You must have known that. She stood it very well. She did not flinch. She said she had suspected it for some time. Then she paid my fee and went out. I never saw her again."
He shut up the box with a snap and closed the book. The pain was slight as yet, but the growth was deep-rooted, he said, and in 3 or 4 months' time she would have been under morphia. An operation would have been no earthly use at all. I told her that. The thing had got too firm a hold.
There is nothing anyone can do in a case like that except give morphia and wait.
No one said a word. The little clock ticked on the mantelpiece, and the boys played tennis in the garden. An aeroplane hummed overhead.
Outwardly, of course, she was a perfectly healthy woman, he said. Rather too thin, I remember, rather pale. But then that's the fashion nowadays, pity though it is. It's nothing to go upon with a patient.
No, the pain would increase week by week, and as I told you, in 4 or 5 months' time she would have had to be kept under morphia. The X-rays showed a certain malformation of the uterus, I remember, which meant she could never have had a child. But that was quite apart. It had nothing to do with the disease.
I remember hearing Colonel Julian speak, saying something about Dr. Baker being very kind to have taken so much trouble.
You have told us all we want to know, he said, and if we could possibly have a copy of the memoranda in your file, it might be very useful.
Of course, said Dr. Baker, of course. Everyone was standing up. I got up from my chair, too. I shook hands with Dr. Baker. We all shook hands with him. We followed him out into the hall. A woman looked out of the room on the other side of the hall and darted back when she saw us. Someone was running a bath upstairs. The water ran loudly. The Scotch terrier came in from the garden and began sniffing at my heels.
"Shall I send the report to you or to Mr. De Winter?" said Dr. Baker.
"We may not need it at all," said Colonel Julian. "I rather think it won't be necessary. Either De Winter or I will write. Here is my card."
"I'm so glad to have been of use," said Dr. Baker. "It never entered my head for a moment that Mrs. De Winter and Mrs. Danvers could be the same person."
"No, naturally," said Colonel Julian.
"You'll be returning to London, I suppose?"
"Yes. Yes, I imagine so."
"Your best way is to turn sharp left by that pillar box and then right by the church. After that, it's a straight road."
"Thank you. Thank you very much."
We came out onto the drive and went towards the cars. Dr. Baker pulled the Scotch terrier inside the house. I heard the door shut. A man with one leg and a barrel organ began playing Roses in Picardy at the end of the road.
Chapter 27 We went and stood by the car. No one said anything for a few minutes. Colonel Julian handed round his cigarette case. Favell looked grey, rather shaken. I noticed his hands were trembling as he held the match. The man with the barrel organ ceased playing for a moment and hobbled towards us, his cap in his hand. Maxim gave him 2 shillings. Then he went back to the barrel organ and started another tune. The church clock struck 6 o'clock. Favell began to speak. His voice was diffident, careless, but his face was still grey. He did not look at any of us. He kept glancing down at his cigarette and turning it over in his fingers.
"This cancer business," he said, "does anybody know if it's contagious?"
No one answered him. Colonel Julian shrugged his shoulders.
"I never had the remotest idea," said Favell jerkily. "She kept it a secret from everyone, even Danny. What a goddamned appalling thing, eh? Not the sort of thing one would ever connect with Rebecca. Do you fellows feel like a drink? I'm all out over this, and I don't mind admitting it. Cancer. Oh, my God."
He leant up against the side of the car and shaded his eyes with his hands.
"Tell that bloody fellow with the barrel organ to clear out," he said. "I can't stand that goddamned row."
"Wouldn't it be simpler if we went ourselves?" said Maxim. "Can you manage your own car, or do you want Julian to drive it for you?"
"Give me a minute," muttered Favell. "I'll be all right. You don't understand. This thing has been a damned unholy shock to me."
"Pull yourself together, man, for heaven's sake," said Colonel Julian. "If you want a drink, go back to the house and ask Baker. He knows how to treat for shock, I dare say. Don't make an exhibition of yourself in the street."
"Oh, you're all right. You're fine," said Favell,
standing straight and looking at Colonel Julian and Maxim.
"You've got nothing to worry about any more. Max is on a good wicket now, isn't he? You've got your motive, and Baker will supply it in black and white, free of cost, whenever you send the word. You can dine at Manderley once a week on the strength of it and feel proud of yourself. No doubt Max will ask you to be godfather to his first child."
"Shall we get into the car and go?" said Colonel Julian to Maxim. "We can make our plans going along." Maxim held open the door of the car, and Colonel Julian climbed in. I sat down in my seat in the front. Favell still leant against the car and did not move.
"I should advise you to get straight back to your flat and go to bed," said Colonel Julian shortly, "and drive slowly, or you will find yourself in jail for manslaughter. I may as well warn you now, as I shall not be seeing you again, that as a magistrate I have certain powers that will prove effective if you ever turn up in Kerith or the district. Blackmail is not much of a profession, Mr. Favell, and we know how to deal with it in our part of the world, strange though it may seem to you."
Favell was watching Maxim. He had lost the grey colour now, and the old unpleasant smile was forming on his lips.
"Yes, it's been a stroke of luck for you, Max, hasn't it?" he said slowly. "You think you've won, don't you? The law can get you yet, and so can I, in a different way."
Maxim switched on the engine. "Have you anything else you want to say?" he said. "Because if you have, you had better say it now."
"No," said Favell. "No, I won't keep you. You can go."
He stepped back onto the pavement, the smile still on his lips. The car slid forward. As we turned the corner, I looked back and saw him standing there watching us, and he waved his hand. And he was laughing. We drove on for a while in silence. Then Colonel Julian spoke.
"He can't do anything," he said. "That smile and that wave were part of his bluff. They're all alike, those fellows. He hasn't a thread of a case to bring now. Baker's evidence would squash it."
Maxim did not answer. I glanced sideways at his face, but it told me nothing.
"I always felt the solution would lie in Baker," said Colonel Julian. "The furtive business of that appointment and the way she never even told Mrs. Danvers. She had her suspicions, you see. She knew something was wrong. A dreadful thing, of course, very dreadful. Enough to send a young and lovely woman right off her head."
We drove on along the straight main road. Telegraph poles, motor coaches, open sports cars, little semi-detached villas with new gardens. They flashed past, making patterns in my mind I should always remember.
"I suppose you never had any idea of this, De Winter," said Colonel Julian.
"No," said Maxim. "No."
"Of course, some people have a morbid dread of it," said Colonel Julian. "Women especially. That must have been the case with your wife. She had courage for every other thing but that. She could not face pain. Well, she was spared that at any rate."
"Yes," said Maxim.
"I don't think it would do any harm if I quietly let it be known down in Kerith and in the county that a London doctor has supplied us with a motive," said Colonel Julian, "just in case there should be any gossip. You never can tell, you know. People are odd sometimes. If they knew about Mrs. De Winter, it might make it a lot easier for you."
"Yes," said Maxim. "Yes, I understand."
"It's curious and very irritating," said Colonel Julian slowly, "how long stories spread in country districts. I never know why they should, but unfortunately they do. Not that I anticipate any trouble over this, but it's as well to be prepared. People are inclined to say the wildest things if they're given half a chance."
"Yes," said Maxim.
"You and Crawley, of course, can squash any nonsense in Manderley or the estate, and I can deal with it effectively in Kerith. I shall say a word to my girl, too. She sees a lot of the younger people, who very often are the worst offenders in storytelling. I don't suppose the newspapers will worry you any more. That's one good thing. You'll find they will drop the whole affair in a day or two."
"Yes," said Maxim.
We drove on through the northern suburbs, and came once more to Finchley and Hampstead.
"6:30, said Colonel Julian. "What do you propose doing? I've got a sister living in St. John's Wood, and feel inclined to take her unawares and ask for dinner, and then catch the last train from Paddington. I know she doesn't go away for another week. I'm sure she would be delighted to see you both as well."
Maxim hesitated and glanced at me.
"It's very kind of you," he said, "but I think we had better be independent. I must ring up Frank and one thing and another. I dare say we shall have a quiet meal somewhere and start off again afterwards, spending the night at a pub on the way. I rather think that's what we shall do."
"Of course," said Colonel Julian, "I quite understand. Could you throw me out at my sister's? It's one of those turnings off the Avenue Road."
When we came to the house, Maxim drew up a little way ahead of the gate.
"It's impossible to thank you," he said.
for all you've done today. You know what I feel about it without my telling you.
My dear fellow, said Colonel Julian, I've been only too glad. If only we'd known what Baker knew, of course there would have been none of this at all. However, never mind about that now. You must put the whole thing behind you as a very unpleasant and unfortunate episode. I'm pretty sure you won't have any more trouble from Favell. If you do, I count on you to tell me at once. I shall know how to deal with him.
He climbed out of the car, collecting his coat and his map.
I should feel inclined, he said, not looking directly at us, to get away for a bit. Take a short holiday. Go abroad, perhaps.
We did not say anything. Colonel Julian was fumbling with his map.
Switzerland is very nice this time of year, he said. I remember we went once for the girls' holidays and thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. The walks are delightful.
He hesitated, cleared his throat.
It is just faintly possible certain little difficulties might arise, he said. Not from Favell, but from one or two people in the district. One never knows quite what Tab has been saying and repeating and so on. Absurd, of course, but you know the old saying, out of sight, out of mind. If people aren't there to be talked about, the talk dies. It's the way of the world.
He stood for a moment, counting his belongings.
I've got everything, I think. Map, glasses, stick, coat, everything complete. Well, goodbye, both of you. Don't get overtired. It's been a long day.
He turned in at the gate and went up the steps. I saw a woman come to the window and smile and wave her hand. We drove away down the road and turned the corner. I leant back in my seat and closed my eyes. Now that we were alone again and the strain was over, the sensation was one of almost unbearable relief. It was like the bursting of an abscess. Maxim did not speak. I felt his hand cover mine. We drove on through the traffic, and I saw none of it. I heard the rumble of the buses, the hooting of taxis, that inevitable, tireless London roar, but I was not part of it. I rested in some other place that was cool and quiet and still. Nothing could touch us any more. We had come through our crisis. When Maxim stopped the car, I opened my eyes and sat up. We were opposite one of those numerous little restaurants in a narrow street in Soho. I looked about me, dazed and stupid.
"You're tired," said Maxim briefly. "Empty and tired and fit for nothing. You'll be better when you've had something to eat. So shall I. We'll go in here and order dinner right away. I can telephone to Frank, too."
We got out of the car. There was no one in the restaurant but the maître d'hôtel and a waiter and a girl behind a desk. It was dark and cool. We went to a table right in the corner. Maxim began ordering the food.
"Favell was right about wanting a drink," he said. "I want one too, and so do you. You're going to have some brandy."
The maître d'hôtel was fat and smiling. He produced long, thin rolls in paper envelopes. They were very hard, very crisp. I began to eat one ravenously. My brandy and soda was soft, warming, curiously comforting.
"When we've had dinner, we'll drive slowly, very quietly," said Maxim. "It will be cool, too, in the evening. We'll find somewhere on the road we can put up for the night. Then we can get along to Manderley in the morning."
"Yes," I said.
"You didn't want to dine with Julian's sister and go down by the late train?"
"No." Maxim finished his drink. His eyes looked large, and they were ringed with the shadows. They seemed very dark against the pallor of his face.
"How much of the truth," he said, "do you think Julian guessed?"
I watched him over the rim of my glass. I did not say anything.
"He knew," said Maxim slowly. "Of course he knew."
"If he did," I said, "he will never say anything. Never. Never."
"No," said Maxim. "No."
He ordered another drink from the maître d'hôtel. We sat silent and peaceful in our dark corner.
"I believe," said Maxim, "that Rebecca lied to me on purpose. The last supreme bluff. She wanted me to kill her. She foresaw the whole thing. That's why she laughed. That's why she stood there laughing when she died.
I did not say anything. I went on drinking my brandy and soda. It was all over. It was all settled. It did not matter any more. There was no need for Maxim to look white and troubled.
It was her last practical joke, said Maxim. The best of them all. And I'm not sure if she hasn't won. Even now.
What do you mean? How can she have won? I said.
I don't know, he said. I don't know.
He swallowed his second drink. Then he got up from the table.
I'm going to ring up Frank, he said.
I sat there in my corner, and presently the waiter brought me my fish. It was lobster, very hot and good. I had another brandy and soda, too. It was pleasant and comfortable sitting there, and nothing mattered very much. I smiled at the waiter. I asked for some more bread, in French, for no reason. It was quiet and happy and friendly in the restaurant. Maxim and I were together. Everything was over. Everything was settled. Rebecca was dead. Rebecca could not hurt us. She had played her last joke, as Maxim had said. She could do no more to us now. In 10 minutes, Maxim came back again. Well, I said, my own voice sounding far away, how is Frank?
Frank was all right, said Maxim. He was at the office, been waiting there for me to telephone him ever since 4 o'clock. I told him what had happened. He sounded glad. Relieved.
Yes, I said.
Something rather odd, though, said Maxim slowly, a line between his brows. He thinks Mrs. Danvers has cleared out. She's gone, disappeared. She said nothing to anyone, but apparently she'd been packing up all day, stripping her room of things, and the fellow from the station came for her boxes at about 4 o'clock. Frith telephoned down to Frank about it, and Frank told Frith to ask Mrs. Danvers to come down to him at the office. He waited, and she never came. About 10 minutes before I rang up, Frith telephoned to Frank again and said there'd been a long-distance call for Mrs. Danvers, which he had switched through to her room, and she had answered. This must have been about 6:10. At 6:45, he knocked on the door and found her room empty. Her bedroom, too. They looked for her and could not find her. They think she's gone. She must have gone straight out of the house and through the woods. She never passed the lodge gates.
Isn't it a good thing, I said?
It saves us a lot of trouble. We should have had to send her away anyway. I believe she guessed, too.
There was an expression on her face last night. I kept thinking of it, coming up in the car.
I don't like it, said Maxim. I don't like it.
She can't do anything, I argued. If she's gone, so much the better. It was Favell who telephoned, of course. He must have told her about Baker. He would tell her what Colonel Julian said. Colonel Julian said if there was any attempt at blackmail, we were to tell him. They won't dare do it. Well, they can't. It's too dangerous.
I'm not thinking of blackmail, said Maxim.
What else can they do, I said. We've got to do what Colonel Julian said. We've got to forget it. We must not think about it any more. It's all over, darling. It's finished. We ought to go down on our knees and thank God that it's finished. Maxim did not answer. He was staring in front of him at nothing. Your lobster will be cold, I said. Eat it, darling. It will do you good. You want something inside you. You're tired. I was using the words he had used to me. I felt better and stronger. It was I now who was taking care of him. He was tired, pale. I had got over my weakness and fatigue, and now he was the one to suffer from reaction. It was just because he was empty, because he was tired. There was nothing to worry about at all. Mrs. Danvers had gone. We should praise God for that, too. Everything had been made so easy for us. So very easy. Eat up your fish, I said. It was going to be very different in the future. I was not going to be nervous and shy with the servants any more. With Mrs. Danvers gone, I should learn bit by bit to control the house. I would go and interview the cook in the kitchen. They would like me, respect me. Soon it would be as though Mrs. Danvers had never had command. I would learn more about the estate, too. I should ask Frank to explain things to me. I was sure Frank liked me. I liked him, too. I would go into things and learn how they were managed, what they did at the farm, how the work in the grounds was planned. I might take to gardening myself, and in time have one or two things altered. That little square lawn outside the morning room with the statue of the satyr. I did not like it.
We would give the satyr away. There were heaps of things that I could do, little by little. People would come and stay, and I should not mind. There would be the interest of seeing to their rooms, having flowers and books put, arranging the food. We would have children. Surely we would have children.
"Have you finished?" said Maxim suddenly. "I don't think I want any more. Only coffee. Black, very strong, please, and the bill," he added to the maître d'hôtel.
I wondered why we must go so soon. It was comfortable in the restaurant, and there was nothing to take us away. I liked sitting there with my head against the sofa back, planning the future idly in a hazy, pleasant way. I could have gone on sitting there for a long while. I followed Maxim out of the restaurant, stumbling a little and yawning.
"Listen," he said, when we were on the pavement. "Do you think you could sleep in the car if I wrapped you up with the rug and tucked you down in the back? There's the cushion there, and my coat as well."
"I thought we were going to put up somewhere for the night," I said blankly. "One of those hotels one passes on the road."
"I know," he said, "but I have this feeling I must get down tonight. Can't you possibly sleep in the back of the car?"
"Yes," I said doubtfully. "Yes, I suppose so."
"If we start now, it's 7:45. We ought to be there by 2:30, he said. "There won't be much traffic on the road."
"You'll be so tired," I said, "so terribly tired."
"No," he shook his head. "I shall be all right. I want to get home. Something's wrong. I know it is. I want to get home."
His face was anxious, strange. He pulled open the door and began arranging the rugs and the cushion at the back of the car. "What can be wrong?" I said. "It seems so odd to worry now when everything's over. I can't understand you." He did not answer. I climbed into the back of the car and lay down with my legs tucked under me. He covered me with the rug. It was very comfortable. Much better than I imagined. I settled the pillow under my head.
"Are you all right?" he said. "Are you sure you don't mind?"
"No," I said, smiling. "I'm all right. I shall sleep. I don't want to stay anywhere on the road. It's much better to do this and get home. We'll be at Manderley long before sunrise." He got in front and switched on the engine. I shut my eyes. The car drew away, and I felt the slight jolting of the springs under my body. I pressed my face against the cushion. The motion of the car was rhythmic, steady, and the pulse of my mind beat with it. 100 images came to me when I closed my eyes, things seen, things known, and things forgotten. They were jumbled together in a senseless pattern. The quill of Mrs. Van Hopper's hat, the hard straight-backed chairs in Frank's dining room, the wide window in the west wing at Manderley, the salmon-coloured frock of the smiling lady at the fancy dress ball, a peasant girl in a road near Monte Carlo. Sometimes I saw Jasper chasing butterflies across the lawns. Sometimes I saw Dr. Baker's Scotch terrier scratching his ear beside a deck chair. There was the postman who had pointed out the house to us today, and there was Clarice's mother wiping a chair for me in the back parlour. Ben smiled at me, holding Winkles in his hands, and the bishop's wife asked me if I would stay to tea. I could feel the cold comfort of my sheets in my own bed, and the gritty shingle in the cove. I could smell the bracken in the woods, the wet moss, and the dead azalea petals. I fell into a strange, broken sleep, waking now and again to the reality of my narrow, cramped position and the sight of Maxim's back in front of me. The dusk had turned to darkness. There were the lights of passing cars upon the road. There were villages with drawn curtains and little lights behind them. And I would move and turn upon my back and sleep again. I saw the staircase at Manderley, and Mrs. Danvers standing at the top in her black dress, waiting for me to go to her. As I climbed the stairs, she backed under the archway and disappeared. I looked for her, and I could not find her. Then her face looked at me through a hollow door, and I cried out, and she had gone again. "What's the time?" I called. "What's the time?" Maxim turned round to me, his face pale and ghostly in the darkness of the car. "It's 11:30, he said. "We're over halfway already. Try and sleep again." "I'm thirsty," I said. He stopped at the next town, The man at the garage said his wife had not gone to bed and she would make us some tea. We got out of the car and stood inside the garage. I stamped up and down to bring the blood back to my hands and feet. Maxim smoked a cigarette. It was cold. A bitter wind blew in through the open garage door and rattled the corrugated roof. I shivered and buttoned up my coat.
"Yes, it's nippy tonight," said the garage man, as he wound the petrol pump. "The weather seemed to break this afternoon. It's the last of the heat waves for this summer. We shall be thinking of fires soon."
"It was hot in London," I said.
"Was it?" he said. "Well, they always have the extremes up there, don't they? We get the first of the bad weather down here. It will blow hard on the coast before morning."
His wife brought us the tea. It tasted of bitter wood, but it was hot. I drank it greedily, thankfully. Already Maxim was glancing at his watch. "We ought to be going," he said. "It's 10 minutes to 12. I left the shelter of the garage reluctantly. The cold wind blew in my face. The stars raced across the sky. There were threads of cloud, too.
"Yes," said the garage man. "Summer's over for this year."
We climbed back into the car. I settled myself once more under the rug. The car went on. I shut my eyes. There was the man with the wooden leg winding his barrel organ, and the tune of Roses in Picardy hummed in my head against the jolting of the car. Frith and Robert carried the tea into the library. The woman at the lodge nodded to me abruptly and called her child into the house. I saw the model boats in the cottage in the cove, and the feathery dust. I saw the cobwebs stretching from the little masts. I heard the rain upon the roof, and the sound of the sea. I wanted to get to the Happy Valley, and it was not there. There were woods about me. There was no Happy Valley, only the dark trees and the young bracken. The owls hooted. The moon was shining in the windows of Manderley. There were nettles in the garden, 10 foot, 20 foot high. "Maxim," I cried, "Maxim."
"Yes," he said, "it's all right, I'm here."
"I had a dream," I said, "a dream."
"What was it?" he said.
"I don't know. I don't know." Back again into the moving, unquiet depths. I was writing letters in the morning room. I was sending out invitations. I wrote them all myself with a thick black pen. But when I looked down to see what I had written, it was not my small square handwriting at all. It was long and slanting with curious pointed strokes. I pushed the cards away from the blotter and hid them. I got up and went to the looking glass. A face stared back at me that was not my own. It was very pale, very lovely, framed in a cloud of dark hair. The eyes narrowed and smiled. The lips parted. The face in the glass stared back at me and laughed. And I saw then that she was sitting on a chair before the dressing table in her bedroom, and Maxim was brushing her hair. He held her hair in his hands, and as he brushed it, he wound it slowly into a thick rope. It twisted like a snake, and he took hold of it with both hands and smiled at Rebecca and put it round his neck.
"No," I screamed. "No, no, we must go to Switzerland. Colonel Julian said we must go to Switzerland."
I felt Maxim's hand upon my face.
"What is it?" he said. "What's the matter?"
I sat up and pushed my hair away from my face. "I can't sleep," I said. "It's no use."
"You've been sleeping," he said. "You've slept for 2 hours. It's 2:15. We're 4 miles the other side of Lannion."
It was even colder than before. I shuddered in the darkness of the car. "I'll come beside you," I said. "We shall be back by 3:00. I climbed over and sat beside him, staring in front of me through the windscreen. I put my hand on his knee. My teeth were chattering.
"You're cold," he said.
"Yes," I said.
The hills rose in front of us and dipped and rose again.
It was quite dark. The stars had gone. "What time did you say it was?" I asked.
20:02, he said.
"It's funny," I said. "It looks almost as though the dawn was breaking over there, beyond those hills. It can't be, though. It's too early."
"It's the wrong direction," he said. "You're looking west."
"I know," I said. "It's funny, isn't it?" He did not answer, and I went on watching the sky. It seemed to get lighter, even as I stared, like the first red streak of sunrise. Little by little it spread across the sky. "It's in winter you see the northern lights, isn't it?" I said. "Not in summer."
"That's not the northern lights," he said. "That's Manderley."
I glanced at him and saw his face. I saw his eyes. "Maxim," I said. "Maxim, what is it?"
He drove faster, much faster. We topped the hill before us and saw Lanyon lying in a hollow at our feet. There to the left of us was the silver streak of the river, widening to the estuary at Kerith 6 miles away. The road to Manderley lay ahead. There was no moon. The sky above our heads was inky black. But the sky on the horizon was not dark at all. It was shot with crimson, like a splash of blood. And the ashes blew towards us with the salt wind from the sea.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of Rebecca. Written by Daphne du Maurier. Read by Anna Macy. Rebecca is also available in digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1938 by the estate of Daphne du Maurier. Audio production copyright 2014 by Audible Incorporated. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.